This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Oh, good morning, everyone. May all beings be free of suffering in every form that suffering takes. All of its obvious and very strong and pervasive forms, but also in its very subtle forms. And may we know the root, the cause, the arising of that suffering. The great heart of compassion of Kenon Bodhisattva is, we could say, is expressed in the four measurables. It's how a selfless, compassionate being not only sees the world, but experiences herself, herself in relationship, and also sees that that's the essence, that's the nature of all people, all human beings. And seeing that, she sees all the various ways in which we manifest, high and low, but she's not fooled by that either. She knows that while we can actualize ourselves in many, many different ways, from hell beings to saintly beings, that essential impulse towards compassion, loving kindness is present within each of us. In training, for those of us on the Bodhisattva path, training as Bodhisattvas, this is also how we bring forth this great heart. We practice it. But how do we do that? How do we hold that great aspiration, trust it, even be able to say it? And sometimes that's a struggle, to even give words, give voice to that aspiration. Because we don't feel worthy or capable or ready. So how do we give voice to that and then practice it, live it, while we're still in our own suffering? How do we bring forth compassion from within and the liberation from within our own entanglements? How do we bring forth clear seeing when we're still in the midst of our own false, cloudy views? How do we trust freeing ourselves from dukkha from within dukkha? When we're angry, sad, depressed, lazy, apathetic, harshly judging, aren't those two in conflict? All things are non-dual. That's the nature of all things. Differences arise from that fundamental unity. But even to speak of unity already creates the sense of something that's not. And this is where language, because of its nature, arising out of the need to see and to describe and to identify and to distinguish, struggles. Our language struggles to be able to express. All differences arise from this one radiant ocean of nature, self-nature. But in their arising, they appear differently. And in their arising differently, they're not inherently two. And so that means it's up to us as practitioners to not make them two, to not divide them, to not divide, not set them apart. Faith Maya says, don't Set what you like against what you dislike. This is the dis-ease of the mind. Don't do that. But we do. This is what the mind does. So how do we practice non-duality from within duality? How do we practice our enlightened mind from within our deluded mind? Well, we bring our attention to one true thing. Now, this one true thing. And we hone our natural given capacity to bring what Bodhidharma called our miraculous awareness, our bright, sharp, clear awareness to now. To this one true thing. And then we examine. We see clearly. And so that means in our aspiration for freedom, we can't reject our lack of freedom when our lack of freedom is appearing in some form in this moment. In our aspiration to be patient, we can't reject or shun our impatience when impatience is now. In cultivating mindfulness, wanting to be mindful, which is our natural mind, to not hate our distractedness when distractedness is now. And so in its arising then, when those states arise that seem to be in conflict with what we're trying to, what we're aspiring to, how do we turn towards, how do we meet that? What is the examination? It's kind of like a clenched fist. So if I've been living with this clenched fist for as long as I can remember, I don't even remember. And so it's not really a clenched fist anymore. Right? There is no before this. And so in that, there's no clenched fist in my mind. Right? There's no sense of this versus something else, because has there ever been anything else? But then as I begin to practice, I realize, I begin to see how this is used. Right? Because it arises from a desire that is trying to accomplish something. That manifests in this particular form to accomplish that particular desire. And so I begin to see the harm that this fist creates. And that can take a while. And it may take a while before it's, because it's, I keep saying, well, if you didn't get in the way of this, then I wouldn't have caused you that harm. But then as I keep going, I realize the energy that it takes to maintain this, which I hadn't noticed before. That precious energy. And then as I continue to practice it and experience it more subtly, I realize that it actually is painful to hold this. And then as I begin to release that, relax that, right? In other words, just cease the activity of this, what Vimalakirti called the total involvement of this, then it begins to manifest in other forms, right? Because one of the things I realize is that this is very limited. I can only use it certain ways. There's so many ways I can't use this, right? Things that come to me that are asking for, needing some other expression of this, and I can't respond. And so as that ancient energy based in desire, based in an understanding, that begins to relax, then I begin to realize this has other possibilities. right? It's not really changing. Nothing is really changing. It's the same thing. But now it can manifest as fearlessness, or as peace, or as an invitation, or as a witness. Same thing manifesting in different ways. And I realized that the anger that I turned towards this fist in the beginning was misplaced, was not necessary at all. That the power was not in the fist itself, unless I understand the fist is mind. And what is that relaxation, that releasing? Because in the midst of a strong wind or a strong current, the tendency is to think that we have to fight back with an equal measure of force. What is that relaxation? It's kind of like when you're tuning a violin and you draw the bow across two strings, right? Because you have to tune this string to another. You can't tune it in isolation because then it doesn't make sense. Tuning it to what? Aligning it with what? And so you draw the bow against two strings. And then as you're turning the peg, and you hear the dissonance, and it's harsh, right? It's not pleasing. And then as you keep turning it, you hear it, and it starts getting closer and closer and closer until finally, and you experience it, right? The person drawing the bow hears it, and you don't just hear it with ears, you hear it with your whole being. Your whole being in that moment relaxes into that alignment of those two sounds. It's interesting that in Western classical music, the very beginning when a piece is, you know, in the key of C major, A minor, that key in a sense is saying, this is home. This is home. And at the beginning of the piece, that is usually established. And so it gets inside of you. This is home. And then you start traveling. And the peace takes you. And it takes you into conflict. It takes you over hills and into valleys and in storms and moments of resolution, but they don't last. And it keeps taking you on this journey until finally you have to return home. Right? It builds up a tension that demands home. And finally, and this is not always true, but finally, in traditional music, it returns. And there's a sense of relaxation, of rest. And it's an embodied experience. That's why we're moved by music, other forms. That's why we experience dissonance, disharmony, conflict in our body. In the whole body and mind. And we also experience the relaxation, the resolution, even just the diminishment, even one step towards the diminishment or resolution of that conflict we experience as a subtle relaxation. To take the musical metaphor even further, on the flute, if you overblow one pitch, one note, and you overblow, you get another pitch. And if you overblow again, you get another pitch, and you keep, and they keep ascending. And all of those actually make up the one original tone. You know, when you hear in the old days, I don't know what they do anymore on TV, at the end of the day when they would sign off when TV used to actually sign off, right? When that actually relaxed. there would be a meh, just like a, you know, that had no, it was very dull. It was not a pleasing sound. And that's because it didn't have all of those overtones, which is what gives it its richness. That's what makes music music. And this, so this one tone is actually made up of all of these different tones. It needs those. Without them, it's bland, uninviting. And so as we work towards our own suffering, we can work in the same way. We have to, really, as we meet suffering, because we will, we do. And not just we meet it out there in the universe, we meet it inside of ourselves because we're still creating it. How could we not? That is our habit. That is our deeply conditioned way of being. And creating suffering means so much more than we think. It's so much more than just the overt, obvious, you know, tangible forms of suffering. So, so subtle. The Buddha realized how deeply this dis-ease goes. Which means the deeper it goes, the more subtle it is, the harder it is to experience it, just like this. Because it's so subtle and so old, we don't notice it until we do. And so we have to, as we practice from within that state, the very state that we're trying to free ourselves of, we have to become very attuned to how to do that. In a book called The Simpler Way, A Simpler Way by Margaret Wheatley and Myron Rogers, who's one of our students, that is a very poetic and beautiful sort of presentation of systems thinking, systems theory. They said, life, free to create itself, moves into particular forms, into defined patterns of being. Pathways and habits develop. Over time, these become boundaries, limiting the freedom of self-expression. Who we are becomes an expression of who we have decided to be. Our choices become limited as we strive to be consistent with who we already are. We reference a self to continue creating a self, and that reference constrains us. Now, they're not presenting that from a Buddhist perspective. And this book was actually written many, many years ago, quite a number of years ago. But they're studying how things work. And so we begin to accept and learn to be okay with our non-acceptance. We have to learn how to accept and be okay when we see that we're not accepting, when we're not okay. And that's compassion. And we have to begin to recognize that that is compassion, because early on, it doesn't look like it. And why doesn't it look like it? Because we know what it looks like. We think, right? We have an idea of what it's going to look like. And it's not that that idea is wrong, but it's usually much, much too narrow. And being narrow, it excludes, it blinds us to all of the many subtle forms of compassion that we're in the midst of. Which means we can't benefit from that understanding and recognize, oh, I am practicing this. Not seeing it, we think we're not. And so we might not practice it. Means we may have to be able to express not being okay. And to realize and to recognize that we can do that and that's okay. And find ways of doing that. And see that we won't get rejected, the world won't stop turning. That our not being okay doesn't have to become stronger or more reified as oftentimes practitioners are afraid of, simply because I speak of it. I'm already speaking of it. Right? That when we speak out of a desire not to strengthen, not to dwell in, but to shift, to move, then that speaking becomes very powerful. And then that's something that we can do for each other, support each other in. And that means that when we experience conflict or any of these states that we experience as difficult, as painful, as challenging, we have to shift our way of seeing them, that they're not signs that something is broken, that something is wrong, and therefore needs to be fixed. Because when we take that view, things pretty quickly become impossible, unworkable. How do you fix you? How do you fix something, a challenge, something that is difficult in the moment? Well, seeing it that way, one of the only ways we can do it is just get rid of it. Make it go away. And so to learn to experience conflict, not as a sign that something is broken and needs to be fixed, but it's just something that is now. And yes, of course, it is arising out of past actions. It is arising out of the conditions of this moment and this mind and this relationship. Yes, that's true. And that's part of our examination. But first, because we so quickly run to trying to fix it, this is difficult. It's hard to tolerate this difficulty. How do I make this difficulty go away? And so it means relaxing and being able to hold that moment, this now, in an open state. Dogen, in his Fast, Skull, and Continuous Practice, says, "The effect of sustained practice is sometimes not hidden, and therefore you aspire to practice. The effect is sometimes not apparent, and therefore you may not see, hear, or know it. Understand that although it's not revealed, it's not hidden. And as it is not divided by what is hidden, apparent, existent, or non-existent, you may not notice the causal conditions which led you to be engaged in the practice that actualizes you at this very moment of unknowing. The reason you don't see it is that becoming conscious of it is not anything remarkable." There's so much in this passage. This effect that he speaks about, the effect of sustained practice, of living an awakened life, can be the fruits of our practice. The Sambhogakaya, the reward body, the changes that seem to be occurring in our lives, in our mind, in our meditation, in our relationships, that are showing us the truth of the Dharma, the truth of the path, the power of it. It's showing us that our karma is evolving, that our entanglements are softening, are beginning to dissolve. All of this is working together, and it inspires us. As he said, therefore you aspire to practice. We see this, and it encourages us. At the same time, he says, there are effects that may not be apparent, and this can be because the changes are so subtle. In a sense, they're happening beneath the surface, which is just our conscious awareness. Although it may not be revealed, it's not hidden. And it's not divided. Because we don't see it, it doesn't mean that it's divided, dualistic. We may not notice the very causal conditions which brought us to those not yet apparent effects. that are actualizing in this very moment that we can't see. And so that's why having faith is important. Having faith in ourselves, just having faith in the nature of karma. The power of right intention, the power of a heartfelt commitment. But we could read Dogen's words differently in another way and say that the effect may not of our practice may also not be apparent because the effect of those actions are not moving us in the direction we want them to be. That there are things that are still present that we can't see yet. They're not hidden, but they're not revealed to us. Even as we sustain sincere practice, you're really trying, you're doing your best. You're doing what you can do. And this is what we need to understand is these deep underlying dispositions, these karmic streams, latent tendencies that can persist and persist and persist. But because, just as Dogen said, because of the nature of our practice that is both manifesting in ways that are apparent and in ways that are not, those dispositions are being affected. Even when we don't see it. And so, but not seeing it, and sometimes struggling to have faith, because sometimes the struggle is great, and the desire to escape that dis-ease is great, and so we struggle to stay with it and persist and put our hearts into it. We bring forth a heartfelt desire. May all beings be free of suffering. May I be free of suffering. And may I know the root of my suffering. And when I say, may I, that means I want myself to be free of suffering, and I want all beings to be free of suffering. And what that means is I mean it. I have to mean it. I really want that. It's not an idle thing. It has to go all the way through. But let's just say it doesn't. It doesn't go all the way through. So take it through as far as you can. Take it as deeply into heart as you can. Mean it as much as you can. That's honest. That's powerful. That's changing in that very moment. And it's embodied. Heartfelt means it's embodied. And if it's easy to do that, if being awake already to your sort of emotional karmic body, if you already feel things deeply, then sometimes what that means is we have to really examine how am I feeling things deeply? How am I using that? What else is there? Because again, it's coming from this, may I be free of suffering and know the root of my suffering. I have to want that. I mean, you know, if we really appreciate how the forces, the interior subtle forces of our conditioning is to keep everything in place, right? That's Mara's function, right? That's why Mara is always appearing and trying to, whatever the, in a sense, the strength of the practitioner is in that moment, they're trying to turn that over, and whatever the vulnerability, the insecurity, let's call it the weakness from the practitioner's perspective is, Mara's trying to bring that forward, flame that. And so what is our groundedness? May I know the root of my suffering. It's like wanting to know the nature of a great tree. You can't just stand back and look at it. That's one perspective. We have to know its leaves, its flowers, its bark, its heartwood, its inner workings, all the way down. And even going down into the roots is not enough, because the roots are in dynamic, mutually conditioned relationship with the soil and bacteria and air and light. And so what began is what we thought was a very simple, straightforward study. I'm going to examine the self. Okay. That seems pretty straightforward. It's all here. But we begin to see, wait a minute. Where is the here of this? We begin to see it's not quite so neat and tidy. It's not quite so limited. And so our examination has to extend. And so it can't just mean the nature of these arms and legs and eyes and belly and so on. But it means the karma of this karmic body. It's mean everything that arises, the inner workings. It means the emptiness, the non-abiding of this karmic body. But what can show me, beginning to recognize or have faith in or see, that this karmic body, this self, is in dynamic contact with you, with everything, and that so much is not hidden and revealed, that everything is not hidden and so much is not revealed? How do I see it? Wanting to, how do I see it? Right? Because I can't just say, okay, show me. You know, I mean, I can't just will myself to suddenly see or experience or know something that is just actually not in my view. So how do I do that? That's why it starts with that desire, that intention. But then what are the signs, the emotions, the tensions, the physical body of, the thoughts of, the energies of, all that arises that is my humanity and all that doesn't arise that is my humanity? You know, and I've spoken about in my early practice when I really started to turn towards cultivating and really practicing bringing forth compassion, it was because it was not there in abundance in my view, in my experience. I was turning towards the practice of what I felt like was not there. And I had the sense, the trust, the faith that it's not that it was not present, that somehow I sort of missed out on that when that was being doled out, but just that it was not manifesting, not appearing. We can study the consequences of our actions. When I do this, what happens? Particularly when I do this, feeling very confident of what this is, and the intention behind the action, and the desire, and the context, and something very differently happens. Right? And so the consequences of my actions, and both just what are my actions? What am I doing? What am I giving energy to? Where do my desires take me? What are those desires? I study my relationships with you, with people who are experiencing my actions, my thoughts, my words, my actions. How's that going? What do I see in my relationships with you? Do I see trust? Do I see intimacy? Do I see the ability to sustain relationships? Do I see honesty? What do I see? When someone does something hurtful to me, what do I feel? Do I feel hurt? Do I feel numb? Do I feel angry? Do I feel deserving? When I do something that is hurtful, do I notice that? When you bring that to my attention, do I feel anything in response to that? And then to take that further, to examine my relationships with other than human things. And not just living creatures, but inanimate things. What is my relationship with things that don't talk back in a language that I recognize? That if I am aggressive or harsh or uncaring, they don't seem to complain, or I cannot see their complaint. I cannot see the pain of those inanimate objects. How do we touch things, take care of things, relate to? How do we think about things? Do we think about things? Everything we come into contact with is relating. We come into relationship with it. It is in relationship with us. What's being communicated? Who we are becomes an expression of who we decided to be, and which can include who others have wanted us to be. We have to include that, right? Because that's a big chunk right there. Practice is not about cutting off. Cutting off is really based in the idea, the old sort of old and not so old, you know, paradigm of friend and foe. Good and bad, succeeding and failing. When we cut something off, we pretty much ensure, and pretty much here means absolutely, that it's going to follow us. It is us. It's not going anywhere. You may not notice the causal conditions which co-created the habit of body and mind, emotion, behavior. The reason we don't see it is that becoming continuous of it, becoming conscious of it, is not anything remarkable. And we might say it's not remarkable because it's just human. It's universal. We could say it's not remarkable because it's happening in every blessed moment. And when we're looking for something specific, the whole world of possibilities is reduced to that one thing, which we will either see or not see. You know, if everyone is deluded, then how inferior can delusion be? If everyone has the enlightened mind, then how special and superior can that be? Dogen said, continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. I would say amen to that. I would say hell yeah to that. Ceaseless practice is not necessarily something people in the world love. Just take a look around. But it should be the true place of return for everyone. Just take a look around. One thing, all things move among them and intermingle without distinction. So think of that as moving in the midst of and intermingling with your anger and your compassion, with your sadness and your joy, with your blaming and your taking responsibility, with your doubting and your having faith, with your shame and with your atonement. All of it, all of those many beings, move among them and intermingle. And when we see that they are standing opposite and picking up their weapons, realize it's not happening anywhere else. Where are we dividing? Where is the rising up? You know, I often will speak to students about, you know, it's like when you go out. When I was in high school, I went through my very short and very mild ascetic period where I hadn't yet encountered the Dharma, but I was reading Alan Watts and other writings. This is your early 70s, and so I was starting to think about, you know, that things just weren't the way they appeared to be, but my mind had something to do with it. And so there were a couple of winters where I would ride my bike to school every day in a t-shirt. And, it's not cold like it is up here, but it gets cold. And I was working with, you know, how to relax into that cold. I couldn't tolerate my hands, so I actually wore gloves, but they didn't work enough, so I wore plastic bread bags over my hands. It was quite a sight, actually. And I slept out in the porch all winter, and I took cold showers. So that was my brief little. But what I was doing, and I didn't really even, you know, of course I, you know, only had a little bit of understanding of what I was actually doing, but there was a sense of how do I work with my mind, right? So when I would turn on the shower, it's cold, right? And everything froze up, right? And I wanted it to go away, right? But then I would just practice relaxing in my mind. And as my mind relaxed, my body relaxed. Or was it that my body was relaxing and my mind was relaxing? Right? And it was still cold, but not in the same way. And I thought, what is that? What's happening? You know, when you're in a conversation or you're listening to something and somebody's angry and you feel yourself rising up, you know, it's like the fortress. Protecting. This is dangerous. We're in danger right now. It's happening. Right? But actually, you're not. Right? Somebody is just angry. That's all. And so then you just, in your mind, or is it in your body? You relax. You just drop. Drop. And now the words enter just as they were before, but now they enter unimpeded. There's no obstruction. There's no hindrance in the mind. And the fear drops away because the hindrance drops away. And we can hear. And hearing, we can also see. We can see the person. We can actually stay in contact. And not just hear the words and not just hear what we call anger, but what else do we hear? What else are we seeing? I think of Dogen like a flower opening in the world. Dogen says, on the great road of Buddha ancestors, there's always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. He's saying, that's what we're in the midst of. We're in the midst of the circle of the way, which is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap until it appears in the mind as something divided. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided. It is not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or even by yourself, it is so. And I think in that moment, all those various moments, very simple, very beginning stages, and as it gets deeper and deeper, that's what we're experiencing. The entire earth and the entire sky is being affected, which just means is present right there, which means it's always present. But when the walls drop and there's no boundary, then we know. And those subtle signs that we can experience in the very beginning of practice are the signs of just this. May we all be free of suffering and know the root of our suffering.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.